Hello, Piper Cats! Today we are very honored to have Una with us. Una, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, still a human being.
She is a superstar in Pie Ladies Amsterdam. She is doing everything for Pie Ladies Amsterdam. And I'll let you talk.
Hi, everyone. I'm Una. I'm running, apparently, Pie Ladies Amsterdam for, oh my God, like longer than 6 years. No, no way. And the 7 is coming soon. Wow. Apparently, the 7 years is coming starting from May. So, okay, now I can officially say 7 years. Yeah. Ooh, wow.
7 years. 7 years is like longer than my visa. So that's a lot.
So I can assume and say that now she went to the basic school, you know.
Yeah, if you think of, Pie Lady is your baby, then yeah, it's now, you know, in school. And
sometimes it feel like, I still try to distribute the load, but sometimes it feels like this indeed.
Let's learn a little bit more about yourself. Have you been living in Amsterdam for a long time?
Yep, I relocated to Amsterdam 11 years ago. So I think that was the love from the first sight, you know, and it was, I'm talking about Amsterdam, not about a person, unless you want to personalize Amsterdam, of course, or personificate, I guess, not personalize or personificate. I think the Amsterdam has very unique opportunities in the sense of meetup scene, but at the same time, it has a lot of pros and cons. Pros, there is a group of people who just attend meetups just for the sake of eating.
Everywhere. It's everywhere, not just Amsterdam, yeah. I'm telling you.
apparently. And it's really saturated. It was saturated before COVID. During the COVID, it was less, let's say, active. After the COVID, it's saturated again. Sometimes you have to make choices, like, where do I want to go? Oh my gosh, there is like 3 or 4 really interesting events and they all happen at the same time. And not all the events making recordings and, you know, sometimes just like the information that stays within. So yeah, I think for me it was really, really important to find, I was not looking specifically for a community. It's more like, you know, the quest for knowledge. And it was like, oh, by the way, like we had a lot of events, but all the events are talks, which is fantastic. I do agree. But at the same time, you, after the whole workday, you go to these talks and the talks go through like direction 1, direction 2, direction 3. And like at the end of the day, your brain is struggling, you know, to get all these concepts together. So you're feeling that you start fuzzing out on the talk number 3. If it was your good day, and if it was your bad day, you start fuzzing out on the talk number 1. And also a big amount of talks are going about like, oh, look at this cool feature. Like, just subscribe to a premium, you know, you're not gonna get that. Or look how awesome thing I done. And like when I start asking questions, but like, what were your, you know, the thought process? What is pros and cons? Like, yeah, you're saying that just use this awesome library, fantastic, but how it's compared to others? Like, why this, why that?
But you were working in tech before you moved to Amsterdam, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's the thing. I was already there. I usually joking that I'm, you know, like the person who is there and not there at the same time. I'm usually try to, let's say, merge both worlds. And like, if I look back at my career, I think I tried almost all. I was only mentioning that I didn't try PhD yet. But for the rest, like working for myself, working for someone else, starting my own company, growing my own company, selling my own company, getting to another one. And by the way, my first job in the Netherlands was an executive director. Yeah, that's how I ended up here. But then after that, I was like, nah, you know, I'm just done. I did some stuff for myself, but now I want to do something for somebody else. And that's how I start freelancing. But I was really scared to start freelancing in the Netherlands because I was like, it's a small country. In case I deliver really shitty product or really shitty data pipelines, you know, what people gonna do?
Okay. Do you feel like it will close down opportunities if you like you didn't do well the first time. Do you feel like it will close it down for you?
Yeah, it's like it's such a tiny country. So basically, the majority of the folks, you know, them are just rotation of the brains between like the big players. And why referring to the big players? I do not mean funk companies. I mean just like the big players on the local markets, whether it's like international companies or local enterprises, but the majority of them. There are some bunch of really like interesting unicorns, for example. And then there's basically migration, as I mentioned, of the brain. Like you go there, then they go there. Then when they fed up doing that, they go there. So there is also like this consulting world, which is like slightly different, but it's almost the same, I would say. And yeah, that's how you get
when it. I was very, very like early in my tech career. I was actually considering moving to Amsterdam and looking for a job there. But I have been told that if you want to work in a consultancy, you have to speak Dutch. So how's your Dutch, Una?
I would say really, het gaat echt goed. Je kunt het verder in Nederlands als je wil, maar I don't think that the audience is going to pick it up. At least the majority of the audience. It's true in case you are aiming for like very top senior positions. It's very, very true. Because when you need to interact directly with, let's say, C-level, C-minus level stakeholders, if it's a Dutch company, they would be Dutch. If it's an international company with some like offices here, they also would be Dutch. And somehow everyone here is bilingual, but they prefer to speak Dutch. And if you don't get it, you can lose a lot of, you know, a lot of nuances. That's true. But I wouldn't say that it's true if you're not interacting directly with stakeholders, unless you're joining some kind of just outsourcing company that, you know, basically don't care about you. They're just selling you per hour and earning the margin on top of it. But it's also like, it's their business. That's how they operate. In this case, they want to hire you as cheap as possible. They want to sell you as expensive as possible. Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, it sounds really tough, but that's what made me want to know more about your journey when you first moved to Amsterdam. Like, do you already have a job or you already have your own company? Like, so where were you at that point in time?
Yeah, so when at that point in time, I sold my company and I was basically looking for a job, and I was looking for a job that will help me, you know, to relocate myself. And there's also like my partner was also at that moment we're looking for a job. So we're like, okay, so if we find, then we are moving, because we didn't want, you know, to just move. We wanted to move with the good conditions under good circumstances, because I'm originally not from, let's say, EU country, which makes it usually very hard. Not very hard, but it's way harder than if you just like do transfer within the EU. Because like if you're from EU, you can go and work in any place. You just need to do some registrations to get some tax numbers and everything. But for the rest, you're free to go. Even if you have EU passport, you can go, for example, and work in Scandinavian countries as well. So you don't need to eat that separate thing, unless it's Great Britain. That's completely different.
Sorry.
Yes. I'm looking at you now, like, wink, wink. Joke, wink, wink.
Actually, like, we also take a hit. So, I mean, who lose more? Never know.
Yeah. So I mentioned like that my first job in the Netherlands was an executive director. So it was basically a service company. You're doing a lot of things, but the goal was to build the company almost from scratch, which was really valuable because I get through all this, you know, I get to experience bureaucracy firsthand. But I wouldn't say that it's a lot of bureaucracy. At least what I'm hearing, for example, from the colleagues who live in Germany, it's a completely different story. So I would say there is a bureaucracy. Yes, I see.
Yeah, because I also have a good friend who lives in Germany, and you know, these two countries, I think, are the top two competing who have more bureaucracy.
Yeah, something like, I would say something like that, indeed. And then I was like, okay, so yeah, what is how the tech scheme looks like? What can I do? What are the companies? And the Netherlands, like some major players, you know, like ASML, you have like Philips. That's like where the majority of the folks are going. They have like, okay, Booking.com and like this, you know, big dinosaurs, let's put it this way. So there are other options, of course, and there are more local options. And I was like, yeah, what should I do? And then I was like, no, I want to feel freedom. So I'm going to go freelancing, which was really strange decision because it came with some changes of the residence permits. By default, like if you're relocated in a specific capacity, you're not allowed to work in for yourself. So there are like a lot of things. So I found a way to do that, like legally and officially. And as I mentioned, that back then I was a little bit like afraid of doing something on the local market because I didn't know how rusty I am. You know, rusty not in the sense that doing things with rust, like in the opposite direction, not related to rust language. The pun intended joke. So, and I was like, yeah, where are I going to go? And like, where I have friends, they're going to help me. Like, I just want to deliver good job, you know, and I don't want to look for the clients or something. I was looking for some kind of low-hanging fruits. And apparently the friends of mine, they were like, oh, just, you know, like if you're interested, like we're working with United States. So we're working with American market. If you're interested, go there, you know, go there. I mean, stay here, but go there and do some stuff. And I was like, yeah, I was really, really excited. So basically for me, legally, it was really easy because my all my, let's say, relationships were with a local company, which, you know, protect me from everything. So in case something happened with the money or clients, it's not my problem, it's their problem. Like they were handling everything for me. So I would say that was freelancing, but it's still like working for someone else, but like with some freedom to say no to specific clients, like let's say like that. And that was funny because you were working with people online, there is a huge time difference. That's where it caught my attention because when we started doing meetings online, people were surprised to know that I'm female. Somehow they were expecting just, you know, another guy. It's a cliche, but it's still. And there was like, oh, are you? Oh, we didn't expect this. I was like, what do you mean by that?
Oh my God. I think people don't check LinkedIn, like, you know, at that time, right? It's not like now people will check your LinkedIn before talking to you.
Oh boy. Yeah. I think there was like, yeah, that's who, like, who are you? I was like, I'm your engineer, you know, who are you?
Can you tell us about this freelancing job specifically? Like, what do you do as a freelancer?
So there was one gig was pure data engineering. So basically you do sensor fusion or a lot of sensor data coming in. You need to process it, very sparse data, and then you ship it to the data scientists. They're going to build different like time series, like statistical and machine, like using different machine learning algorithms on top of that. That was like the first one gig. It was approximately 4 or 5 months. And then I was dragged into the more, let's say, ML-related gig. Again, there are like data scientists and they're struggling to put things in production. Could you help us to go there, you know, set up some, like bring some software engineering practices in place, help us like with CI/CD pipelines, specifically for machine learning training, introduce continuous training where it's possible, set up specific metrics and threshold for monitoring. And that was really interesting because at that moment, that was a very, very awesome project. I was working with self-driving trucks. Ooh. And that was like, whoa, that's where I learned first time in my life what LiDAR is. Before that, I have no clue, like that this thing that do this like 365 degree, like your 3D coordination position. And then it's basically allows you, let's say, to see, and then you can run on this like combination of computer vision algorithms together with all this, let's say, sensor data that coming in, like combination of that. And then you get like the full picture of what's going on. That I think was for me really, really eyes opening. Because, you know, before that, like, what's the problem? You just say, don't hit this. You know?
Cool.
And after that, I jump on the different thing. So I get back to more like maritime industry. And that was the moment of help to predict the best time for crew rotation. So you have like a crew who stays for a longer term on the ship. And when ship arrives to a specific coast, you need to take in account the weather, take in account the nationality of the crew that has to be rotated, taking into account visa conditions of the country they're gonna port at, plus like weather condition I mentioned, like condition also like of the ocean, how it's like behaving, how it's working, and then what is the probability that the ship gonna be at this port versus that port, what is the most, let's say, optimal condition for rotation, which can save a lot of money or which can even prevent rotation of the crew, for example, visa regime is not favorable. Also, you get a lot of like repair teams. So there are a lot of repairs that happens as soon as the ship is moving. So there are big repairs that you do in, for example, in different types of docks, but there are also repairs on go. So imagine like the folks that flying with like this very excessive baggage. And then, for example, they're losing a bag and the bag has like all the tools, like, you know, like, and the tools, cost of the tools are just like
put an air tag in it.
Yeah, like there were tags in it. The bags was also secured because it's very expensive. But still, you know, it's like depends on their company. Like, do they have like the specific tracking? Do they have, if the luggage is lost, it's usually not a problem of their company. It's a problem of handling company at the airport in the majority of the cases. It is what it is. Wow. Yeah.
It's super complicated. I think that's, I never thought that you need to, like, the way you describe this, managing, you know, ship crews as they port. Because I, you know, I enjoy cruise ships. Like, yeah. I've only done it a few times, but it is a very big production to me, like, managing the shipping crews. There was Netflix shows to show just how they run the restaurants inside the cruise ship, planning meal or logistics. Because once you're inside the ship, you don't get to reload or something. So now you're talking about the actual crew management using, I guess, as a software engineer, you write some program for that. That's kind of fascinating. Do you use Python for all of this?
Partially, like when it's possible. But you know, the fancy is when I decided that I don't want to do freelancing anymore and I just want to work for a local company, I went back to consulting because I couldn't find a company that's going to satisfy, you know, my needs in the, like, with the awesome topics that I want to work at. And that's how I joined the consulting, like the local consulting company. Let's say it was an outsourcing company. It's still an outsourcing company, but they also have like this separate department called IT and innovation. That's where I landed. And that's where I get an opportunity to build the whole thing from almost, let's say, from scratch. And that's where I switched to working with aircraft. So like now you can think about each aircraft. So how much food should we put in it? How much water? Oh. How much fuel? Let's say based on the amount of passenger that's arrived for registration, should we swap an aircraft? You know, how the operations of the airport is going to run, knowing what is expected amount of passengers from, let's say, from the local air company.
So I have a random question.
Yeah, go on.
I have heard in my previous job that a lot of, you know, air traffic planning is using Prolog. Is that true? Do you know, or you don't touch that part of craziness?
I touched this part because I would say that one of my latest gigs was redesigning basically the whole data and AI system for a very big pan-European company, which is controlling European sky. Like, there are a lot of things going on there. They're solving problems that are not common, and they're solving very unique problems. That's why there is a lot of custom built stuff, because otherwise the way how the information is shared, like how you can parse it, which makes it very, very difficult and completely different from others. You even can have like up to 12 languages used for different components. Because what they do, you know, the funniest part, I never thought about airspace like that. They calculate airspace and they create like cubes, and they calculate the capacity of each cube to flow through it. And each cube is operated by like ATC, or a combination of cubes is operated by ITC, by this like the air traffic control tower. And basically when the aircraft is flying, the ATC just passing it from one chunk of cubes to another chunk of cubes.
Like, next time I have a delay in my flight, I will think of you, so.
Yes. No, oh, wait. Do not think of me. Think about the cubes. That's where.
Yes.
Because of the weather or because of the other things. But you know where you can hear that? So for example, when the pilot says, oh, sorry, we just missed our time slot for departure. Yeah. That's exactly, they missed their claimed space in a cube.
Oh.
Yeah, that's okay. Happened a lot. Like when after, you know, the pandemic and also during the summer season, it happens a lot. Especially with some flight company that is really cheap and start with an R. It happens a lot.
Okay. We're not going to pick up the topic of Coldplay and they are divorcing couples, right?
Oh. I was just looking at that the other day, yesterday.
Don't.
It's okay. Yeah, let's not gossip about it. Yeah.
Let's change the topic.
Yeah.
What sparked you started Pie Ladies in Amsterdam?
You know, it sounds really strange, but the smells and the sounds. So I was attending a lot of meetups. Usually I was mostly one, or maybe like there were two of us. Like they were, can let's say, be identified as females, if I put it this way. And the majority of the meetups starting with guys drinking a lot of beer. They eating very bad quality pizza, but like, I know, it's still like free of charge food. but it's like very, very bad. And at that moment, I was not drinking alcohol at all. So for me, it was really problematic because I was smelling it. And I was smelling and the beer and the pizza and the guys. Sorry. I'm just
in the summer, I can imagine it's really tough. Yeah. Love. Crowded place, very hot, you know, it's not going to be nice.
Yeah. And I was like, what if there could be a meetup where first it would be not about talks, it would be mostly about still doing something, doing some exercises, like trying out a learning new concept, not just watching a demo. Like I wanted something that I can, you know, like run. It runs on my machine. So something like that. Or if you need some specific credits, like to run it somewhere else. And I wanted to have a space where I can influence a bit the food and the drinks. I was not saying that like I am against alcohol. It's not about that. It's more about it's okay to have alcohol, but at the end during the networking part and not during the event. Because if you aim to do workshops, then, you know, that's something different. So that was my idea. And I'm really thankful that at that moment I meet another person who was like, so if we both dissatisfied, why not to start something new? And we're like, okay, so what should we do? How we should do it? Like, should we create a meetup group? And then what? Where to advertise it? I don't know, go to the events and talk. Oh, we have this cool idea. Just go for it. And there was like, are there any low-hanging fruits or something? And next to it, I would say my desire was to see more, let's say, female and underrepresented groups on the stage, you know, taking the spot and not just being somebody's like assistant or something like that. And I was like, yeah, maybe there is something. And then just like with a short discovery, we noticed, oh, there was a Paradis Amsterdam chapter. Unfortunately, they somehow like stopped their activities in 2014. Yeah, I guess something like that. There was some folks running it. So really thankful that they started it. And we're like, oh, could we resurrect the zombie horse, you know? And that's how we started. And what was really funny today when I was chatting, sending DMs to Marietta, I scrolled down and I noticed my first message to her, like saying, hello, I'm doing this. I'm trying to get access to here and there. Could you help me? Thank you for understanding. It was so nice to see it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the same. I've heard these stories a lot, like everything you said, you know, like we all here, we want to see more people who we can relate to, you know, want to see more women in the community. There are lots of PyLadies chapters worldwide who just, you know, people started it, maybe they have other priorities afterwards, and then it got dormant. I'm really glad to hear that, you know, you picked it up and you run it and you have your own vision of, you know, what kind of community you want. I think that's really good to hear. I'm more used to hear of people complaining, like saying, there should be something for me here. Like, I want an event like this. You should be running an event the way I want it. But yet they're not running it themselves. They're just saying, you should run conference like this, this and that. But when we ask them, why don't you help out? Why don't you run it? They say, no, I'm busy.
Of course.
So I'm really thankful that you are actually doing it.
There is a lot of people who are telling me it's not going to work. Like workshops, it's impossible to do. I mean, like workshops, you have to prepare. First, you need to find someone who wants to give it like free of charge. It's a lot of work. You need to just meet with a lot of like trial and errors to get, you know, what's the, like how to do it. Like what are the formats that are going to work? So what's going to work? What's going to not? But everybody will tell me it's impossible. And especially if you want more like underrepresented groups running the workshops, no way, you know, no way. Like it's not going to work. But what I learned, you know, the compound effect, that's what works. So if you go in no matter what, and if you're delivering, people start noticing you, people start talking about you. And what was for me is really, really eye-opening. Before COVID, all the events were in person. We were not doing recordings because it was too hard to set up everything back then. It was like, oh no, you know, you're just doing it. And you constantly was looking for sponsors, like who's going to pay, you know, who's going to host, who's going to feed us, let's say at our workshop giver. And the workshop takers. And that was constant. Like, oh, there was a list of companies. We tried to reach out to the big companies. They say no because they were more interested in like events that's going to attract 150 people versus event that attracts 60 people, because we have this 60 people max capacity for in-person events. Otherwise, for the workshop, it's really hard to handle. If you want to help, if you want to support people, then, you know, that's not going to happen. I mean, with more than 60, at least that's what we learned and always like, as soon as COVID started, we didn't stop. When a lot of communities just closed or shut it down, we just switched online and we start experiencing the beauty of doing things online, because that's where we realize, oh, by the way, in case there is no one to host you, you can host yourself online. And then the people say, no, online is not going to work. People not going to show up for the events. You know, that's, I was like, look, if we're just doing online events, we now have a capability of recording it. So now you're recording it and there's also a video record of it. Although there are still a lot of ads on YouTube, I notice if you add in timestamps, then it slightly decreases the amount of ads that you get, because it's also correlated to a lot of factors. Like, do you have like paid ads or whatever? We don't use that. So in this case, you just get like general ones. You keep repo open. Of course, some materials could be outdated. So we usually encourage people, if you try in our workshop, something doesn't work, please open PR, you know, just do that. So you're going to help yourself and you're going to help others, because, you know, the methods got deprecated. Other things are going to happen to the materials. For example, we were heavily using mini content in the beginning, just like for the setup and everything. Then we switched to poetry. Then we switched to youth. So like, we also like migrating stuff, but we couldn't migrate everything. But yeah, I think that was the beauty of it. And then after COVID, like as soon as you can do more stuff, we basically switched to, we're not looking specifically for anyone to host our workshops. Company usually reaching out to us. If no one reaching out to us, then super simple, like we just do online. And it also helps you to get workshop givers from different countries as well. So that's also the beauty of that.
These are all very good advice. Yeah.
I remember last year at PyData Amsterdam, Una was at the booth. So there's a booth for Py ladies. And then she's asking every ladies that she talked to, you want to give a workshop? And this is...
Yeah.
This is like stuck in my head. Yeah.
I think that's really good. Yeah.
I think what's stuck in my head, last year I was at EuroPython. So I was like at PyLadies booth. And I think I had like a 4 o'clock flight in the morning, something like that. So I was not in my best mood. So I came and that was like my analytical me in the full force, which is not really compatible, you know, with human beings around. And I remember that I just stormed to the booth and I was like, we are PyLadies, we're doing this. Oh, and PyLadies, I'm set up doing workshops. And I think if you're going to put a counter, how much time I mentioned workshops by the end of EuroPython. I think everyone, that's crazy lady that's talking about workshops.
Oh my god.
I think it's really good to hear your experience. As you know, I'm one of the people who administer the chapters for PyLadies. Basically, whenever someone say, I want to start PyLadies, I'm the one giving the initial like access, creating their account and everything. I think there's a lot of people, they want to start a group, but they don't know how to, or they don't know what it entails. Maybe, you know, some people think, I just open a meetup account, but there's a lot of into it. Like you mentioned, like you need to outreach, you need to ask people to come and speak, right? Giving workshops and figuring out what's a good format or not. So I think it will be good to share all of this experience with people. Like, yeah.
You know, if I may to add, what's really interesting, my goal is not to create workshop givers. That's not my goal. My goal is to encourage people to try it out, realize whether it's hard, not hard, like it doesn't matter. But then I was constantly asking myself why I'm doing this. You know, what's the purpose of running it for so many years? Why didn't, you know, there was like a lot of changes in other like co-organizers. We also, by the way, we keep our team really, really small. So the biggest amount of people we used to have, it was 3. That was the biggest amount. And now like there are again 2 of us so far. So I'm happy to see that our workshop givers now speaking at the conferences. And I think that's for me the best win. Even though they can, for example, speak even for local events, I'm already happy with that. It gives them confidence that they can. It gives them confidence that you can do that. And, you know, there is nothing weird about that. And to lure people to do that, I'm usually talking about 2 options. I'm saying option number 1, you're working with some specific Python library or specific concept. You're working every day. For sure, there are a lot, like a lot of tricks up on your sleeve. not slips upon your trick, it doesn't matter. Butter with butter. So you probably know something that other people don't. So just share it. Like, even though you're working with pandas, I mean, like, there are so many things that you can do. Like, there are so many, like, how you handle UTC. I mean, there are a lot of things. And people do not realize that. So I'm usually saying, focus on something that you're doing every day and just share what you can share, of course, like protecting sensitivity of the data, of the task, if it's like intellectual property and everything, or your employer doesn't allow you to share something, fine. But from the other side, I'm saying maybe there is something on your bucket list that you never dare to try and you never had time for that. And then if you can tap into that potential, it's like you can try it and then you can run it and then you can upskill people on that. And by the way, if you also have some kind of, I don't know, like a performance or whatever, call it stupid plan on your work, and you can also add it there, so where basically you will be allowed even to use your working hours for that. So it's like win-win situation for everyone. And somehow it works so far.
It definitely have been helpful for me as well. And I totally agree. Like, even in the beginning, I didn't think public speaking is something I could ever do. At least when I first came to one of my earlier tech conference, one of my first PyCon, like, I was really impressed to see a lot of women speaking. Before that, another conference I've been to, it was very commercial. The speakers are all CEO or CTOs or something, very high up. I don't see normal people like me speaking on stage. So I just thought that you must be a professor or CEO to speak at conferences. But it's not, at least not in the Python community and definitely not in the PyLadies community. So I do feel it is the purpose of this community to provide that space, and you should take it.
Yeah. And I think you just, like, you know, give away my secret, because, like, that's my motivation of, you know, I love giving workshop because, like, I get it as an opportunity to really, like, strengthen what I already know, or maybe I know a little bit, but I want to know more. Then after I learn it, then because I know how to explain it to other people. So it's like, you know, I think it's a very good, like, learning opportunity for whoever is, like, giving the workshop as well. Yeah.
And it's not only this, I think. What for me is really, really important, I want to recreate your current working situation in the room. So what do I mean by that? Like, at least like our chapter, that was our decision, that we allow in anyone, doesn't matter, like, whatever, you know, the society, like, put what type of labels on them. So basically, if you're interested in, if you're working with Python and you're interested in this particular topic, join us. If not, no, you know, really simple. But the workshops would be given, so we have at least 12 workshops per year, so at least 11 workshops would be given predominantly by females or transgenders or other different options that exist nowadays, let's put it this way. So, like, that's the power. And it's really funny to see people when you're talking to them and they were like, oh, you know, I can give a workshop. I was like, yes, I do agree, you can give a workshop. We have only one slot for you per year. Otherwise, if you don't do any big contributions to the community, you wouldn't be given this slot. So, which means you need to pair up with your female or other colleagues and let them run the workshop. Oh, we don't have senior women. Okay, even as junior women, give her space to run a workshop and just be there, not as somebody who stands in front of her, no, as her shadow. Like, try it. And yeah. I think for me, the funniest part was to see in our first workshops where in the room were only like two or three guys, and one of them, you know, walked toward me and was like, now I do understand. How does it feel? Now I do understand. I've never ever been in a room with such a big amount of, like, female engineers. So what I meant by saying before that, I want to recreate what you're going to see in the workplace. That's why we are open for everyone. So usually if you look at our workshops, it's really mixed. It's always a mix. So the guys, there is like the females and other, and I really enjoy it, because what I didn't like with a lot of female communities, they keep you in a bubble. They keep you in a bubble, mm-hmm. Sisterhood, support, everything, but it's not real life. I just want to prep you for the real life. Yes, it would be not easy, but at least you know how to find your sponsors, you know how to find your allies, you know, like, how to build your career up, how to manage up people if you're gonna work with different people. And I had some experience, like, with, like, pure female communities, which I really didn't like, and that's the reason why I said I'm creating an inclusive community with some, you know, with some, let's say, remarks,
with some adjustments.
Yes, Yes.
I still think that I do agree with you, but I think that, you know, there are different purpose of this kind of underrepresented kind of focus group. I think one of them is what you said. I think it's beautiful, but I think if someone wants to have a more kind of, you know, support network, that's also okay too. But remember, like, maybe you should form this group to join the majority group so you can integrate as well.
I think the only part which we usually do not cover, so we usually do not cover something for complete beginners. We did some events in the past, but then we switch fully to more, let's say, mature folks. So in this case, if they're a complete beginner, we usually send folks to the other communities that exist that are more and more, let's say, better suitable for complete beginners. If you just start working, for example, with any programming languages, Python is your first, or if you switch it from another one to Python, or vice versa. So in this case, we do redirect them to other places where they can find information, because like for beginners, there is a lot of things.
You can send people to us, Humble Data, because we are absolute beginner focused.
We do. We're also going to do this for PyData Amsterdam, by the way, this year.
Nice.
So this is going to happen as well. Yes. But that's our focus. I usually say it's like, you know, community by practitioners for practitioners, or for practitioners by practitioners.
I think that's good. I think that's good that you found what kind of status that the meetup is, like what purpose it is, what benefit it can give to the members. I think it's beautiful.
No, I think that's actually important for you to define what you want out of your community. Like, you can't just be doing everything just for the sake of doing it. You need to have a vision, priorities.
Yeah, do you have anything that you really want to talk about that we didn't cover? We can do that.
I think, yes. One topic that I really want to touch upon, there's like the recruitments. I just want to add something about that.
Okay, please.
But first thing first, like I finally got, I signed an offer today. Ooh. So that's finally.
Oh, congratulations.
Your journey. Yes.
Yeah, that was a long journey.
Yeah.
So
tell us about it.
Yeah. One thing that I want to point out, and that's where things get really, really weird, is when you're looking for a very top level positions, and that's where the rubber hits the ground. Mm. So before that, I was privileged not to, let's say, looking for a job. The jobs were looking for me. Yeah. So I was usually, you know, it doesn't matter like what I was doing, whether it was my company or not my company, somehow I like organize space around me in such a way that people start reaching out. So that was my reality for, I would say, the last 20 years. So I was privileged to, you know, to be in that. And when people are saying, oh, you know, now around the layoffs and everything, I was like, thankfully, never hit by layoff. I have never experienced it because I was always feeling that something is going on. So I was usually switching gears before the layoffs were happening. Just say, that's just like my, I don't know, call it sixth sense or stupid sense,
like,
or whatever.
Stink.
Yeah. So I had some personal changes. That's the reason behind like the selling house and everything. And apparently I was working for myself and I went to chat with my bank. So I will need a mortgage for like part of the sum. So like, can I get it and whatever? Like, or can I move the mortgage that I have in the house to that? Like, it's they call it like overbrugging, which means like overbridging, which I really like. Like the whole term. Basically, the idea was if you're working for yourself in the Netherlands, it's possible, but you would not be given a mortgage unless you have 3 years of operations. And with my company, latest company, had only 1 year of operations, which means that I need to return to the workforce. So basically, I need to get to work for someone else, because like if you want to get a mortgage, if I want to leave. And the reason like why I want to take a mortgage, why just not to rent, the prices of taking a mortgage is 2 times lower versus renting. That's the difference. And the market is crazy. Of course, I can go to a smaller village, leave Amsterdam. It's always the case. The problem is in the smaller village, there would be the same price, but you get more square meters. I don't need more square meters. That's the thing. So getting back, staying on track, I have to find a job. Basically, like I have to work for someone else. I have to get a permanent contract or like a temporary contract with some things next to it to get a mortgage or to extend my mortgage. So I started my search. It was in May. I started my search in May. So I was really, you know, like, I'm going to read descriptions. I'm going to see what's there. So the positions I was heading for were like head of director of artificial intelligence. So I was applying for different companies. So I like choose three. I was really, you know, like picking out where I want to apply. I applied there and guess what? Nothing, like completely nothing. I was like, okay, maybe, you know, if we assume that a lot of recruiters and enterprises using AI tools now, then let's use AI again to apply. So I generated a batch of things tailored per each use case, whatever. I send it, nothing. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? I'm already like, there are 2 weeks in the process and nothing comes out. Like, how it's even possible? And then one smart person told me, you know, just take a batch and do batch a plane, literally. Of course, you can go via like false, you know, who can refer you and blah, blah, blah. But do batch, because in case start like, treat it as a funnel. And then, you know, as you go, pick up. And I was like, yeah, but it's not what I wanted. That's not what I want to do. Just go. So I created one batch dedicated to the position of this like director or head of artificial intelligence. And I created the second batch for ML staff engineer or AI staff and engineer or principal engineer or something like that. And I started applying. So here start this traction. And the funniest part was the first screening calls. The screening calls were like, the first question in the Netherlands is, what's your salary expectations? They usually said like, put your salary expectations in the form, even in the recruitment form. That's where I were testing their front ends and back ends by putting minus one, zero, 0.5, you know, like everything. Like, let's try how it works.
Oh my God.
So the funniest part is I'm usually try to jump in front of this question from recruiter, because usually the first who asks this question gets the better question in position, at least at the Dutch market. Let's put it this way. Although I was applying for a lot of EMEA remote positions. So I was like, okay, let's do that. And I usually start in, okay, so what is the expected salary range? Like, I'm asking specifically for range because it gives them freedom, you know, to go from where and just to show me the boundaries. So then we can discuss later, like, how it's going to work. The funniest part is there was a lot of really top level positions with salary, which were below like even like senior engineer positions. And I was like, I'm sorry, like with this responsibility, like why? And then you get really weird questions. There's like, why do you need so much money?
Why not?
I would try to answer the question. It's like, I want to donate to the Python community. That's why I need money. Come on. Like,
yes.
Maybe that's a good question. Like, good answer. I don't know.
Like, that's the reason people work, to get money.
Jesus.
And I was like, oh, you know, and it's like, you're working free of charge? It's like, no. It's like, strange. Why should I work free of charge?
Yeah.
Yeah, they pay you by Bitcoin, no?
By beautiful eyes.
Beautiful so, eyes.
Yeah. So like, but to cut the long story short, I ended up, like the end of the funnel was for companies. And then I did another twist. When I was in the process of these companies, I was telling them directly that you are not the only one. So, you know, we can play silly game and said, yes, of course, you're the only one company I ever dreamed to work for. Sure. Fine. Right. So I was telling them, and it's really interesting to see the reaction. Some of them were like, you know, it's not good that you're saying that. I was like, yeah, I know it's not good, but because we are in the final stages, I want to be clear that, like, I expected offers coming in, and I'm going to, surprise, surprise, I'm going to compare the offers. Surprise, surprise. And I'm going to ask for what I want, you know? So that's the thing.
Company are expecting people to be like lying on Tinder, right? Like, I only have eye on you. It's like, no,
that's, of course
not.
One eye, like, on you and the second eye on
Tinder. People are swiping all the time, right? Like, it's just so funny. Sorry. Please continue.
But then, you know, the funniest part, so like one of the companies, there were some like holidays, and they basically like, they dropped the ball. So I didn't hear anything from them like for 3 weeks. Now they came back to me like, oh, let's schedule an interview. And I was like, okay, let's schedule. And then I was like, oh, sorry, like, please cancel the interview because I already have offers. Although it's a final interview, but it's like an interview with C-level folks. I don't want to rob their time, you know, that's it.
Lead them on, and, sorry. No.
Yeah. And then the question would be, you know, when they're going to look how we lost this candidate at the end, they would be, oh, we lost this candidate because of competition. No, you didn't lose this candidate because of competition. You lost this person because you were not responsive for three weeks. And like, I need to eat. Sorry, the girl's got to eat, you know?
Yeah, very interesting. I felt the culture of hiring is somewhat different. I mean, in North America, and like, we went through the same thing when I apply for a job. I I have to apply for like 10 different companies and maybe I get interviewed for one or two, right? And it's the same thing, but something's different. It's like, I mean, it's definitely okay for me to say, yeah, they will ask, am I interviewing for other companies? Like, I will say yes. Yeah. Like, especially if when you say you're hiring, you're interviewing for higher level position. That yeah. means, you know, you have lots of skill.
But you can ask
a lot
them.
Of people want your skill.
But you can ask them, like, are you only considering one candidate? No. So
yeah,
why not? It's like, you know, give and take, right?
So. Yeah, it's both ways. It's both ways.
Yeah. So yeah, that's basically what I wanted to share. For me, it was really a surprise. First, it was like a lot of questions like, why do you need the salary? Like, why do I need a salary? Come on.
You can try asking kindergarten's children and they would also give you a very reasonable answer. You, I mean.
Yeah. And the second one is like when you're like getting to the top, like when you get into the ends, they usually also like the recruitment process is not very clear. I'm usually asking about the structure and usually they don't have a proper structure for such positions. It goes like, oh, we're going to have 3 interviews and that's it. And then you ended up having 9 interviews. That's the story.
Is it like a reality? This show like you
have you know, like interview from hell.
Yeah, you'll be like, excuse me.
Yeah. Not the Squid Game, you have to so many rounds.
Yes, ladies. Yeah, that's a journey. I'm happy that, like, I do hope for the right one and, like, we will see.
I'm really impressed by, like, you just kind of, like, have the mindset of, like, if I want to work for myself, I can work for myself. If I need a job because of the mortgage, I can have a job. I think this is a resilient that it can inspire a lot of people.
I was watching this TV show on Netflix. It's an Indonesian movie, Home Sweet Loan. It's like also a journey of a woman. Like she wants to be independent from her family. She wants to have a piece for herself, a property by, you know, working for herself, by like she wants to work and in order to qualify for mortgage. So like when you talk about this, it reminds me of that movie. Very interesting. Well, thank you so much, Una and Chuck. Thank you everybody for listening. Enjoy the episode and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.